Welcome to today's episode of Fire in the Belly. This is where we get to hear some pretty inspiring stories from some amazing people. You know, it's always an absolute pleasure to sit down, take time out, and have a warts and all conversation about their journey. I'm always intrigued by what it's taken for people to get to where they are today. And hopefully, in this interview, we get to hear some more about that. From this, my mission is to help people to find their own fire in their belly, and from that, to live the mightiest version of you. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy today's guest. Success is a process, not an event. Hello and welcome to Fire in the Belly. Today we have myself, Mighty Pete, and we're joined by Francesca Cosman. Good afternoon or good morning. Yes, good morning for you.
Thank you, Pete, for having me. It's such an honor and pleasure. I'm really excited.
Cool. Listen, thank you for coming on.
Thanks.
Tell us, who are you? What are you doing? Where are you from?
Sure. Okay, so who am I? I am a singer, composer, music producer, podcaster, and now podcast expert coach. And I am also a mom and a wife. And I am one of seven children, and I grew up in Moscow, Russia. Now I live in Philadelphia in the States.
Well, that's quite a journey. There's a lot going on there.
Yes, absolutely. So my parents moved to Russia in 1989 as a rabbi and rabbi's wife. So I'm Jewish Orthodox. And I grew up in Moscow. And then at the age of 15 and a half, I went to a religious seminary in Israel for a year and a half. And then I came over to the States. Backtracking a little, my father's European and my mother's American. So I was going to my mother's family and going to school here in the States. And I stayed here, and then I got married and I stayed here again. So that in a nutshell.
That's quite a transatlantic journey you had going on there.
Yes, it still has to happen every time my kids want to see their grandparents. So.
Oh, fair play. So tell us, I mean, what does Fire in the Belly mean to you then?
Well, it resonates with me a lot because I do that a lot with my podcast and my work, because just to give a little background, as a female Orthodox Jewish singer, singing is pretty complicated because Jewish men are not, to the letter of the law, to the Jewish tradition, are not supposed to be listening to the woman's voice. So that limited me in a big way, and I was searching for my place and for a market for what I do. So I started to interview women like me in the arts and entertainment, trying to figure out what the journey was like for them. Do they feel satisfied? Do they feel heard? And slowly over 3 years, I built up a database. I built up a market, also a camaraderie amongst the women who are in this space. And I added on a series once a month. I interview survivors of abuse. So my theme becomes, you know, talking about the elephant in the room or giving the underdog a voice. And that's just that. So the fire in the belly is, you know, what drives you? What's that fire within you that doesn't allow you to just sit quietly and take life as it comes, but something that's making you get up in the morning and fight for something?
And is that something you would feel a lot?
Well, now that I've activated that in myself, I definitely feel that a lot. I normally do not go into politics or anything like that, but since the elections now have been happening, I felt a writing block that was definitely preventing me from talking about my business and about my services online, which, you know, it can't go on for too long because then my business will dry up. So I felt like I had to deal with the elephant in the room. So I just did two nights ago. I invited two guests, one from the left, one from the right, and I had them prepare a bunch of questions for me. And I stayed neutral. I released it. I got a record amount of listens after I posted it that same night. So I feel like I was definitely able to address my elephant, the fire going on around me, even though I didn't really partake in the conversation, so I can just move on. So I could just move through the emotion. I didn't want to just feel like I'm silenced or I'm a bystander.
So the way the language you use and what you talk about there is quite, comes across as quite intuitive. Is that a fair assessment?
Definitely. Definitely. I have thought out many things. I feel like there's a lot of thought process that goes into what I do, especially being in the public eye. And I have been since a very young age, you know, being a rabbi's daughter and the house being open and having guests every weekend, feeding an unknown amount of people every week because you never knew who would show up at our Shabbat table. So, you know, I always was aware of people that are watching me or people expect something of me. I have to play a certain role. And then, you know, building my own brand as a singer and then building a business, I've had to learn how to find my voice and not just go with, you know, what I was brought up to be or think.
That's interesting in terms of obviously your, you know, so because I mean, the things you talked about is feeling satisfied and feeling heard. I mean, do you feel satisfied and do you feel heard?
It's a very interesting question. I do. I really feel heard. It's a magnificent feeling because what I chose to do with my life is very unorthodox, untraditional. Most people I know, they go on to become a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer or anything but a singer. What the heck does a singer mean, you know? Especially in a market or in a religion where the women don't even have a platform to sing. You know, the weddings and the regular venues are not even available for women to perform on. They have to be special events where women come out for women only. And they usually have less funding available for that. So I definitely feel like I didn't begin the movement, but I definitely added some fuel to it. I definitely brought a lot to the table, a lot of unity, a lot of information, a lot of data. I brought stories together. So it definitely made it meaningful. It made me feel less alone. And I'm definitely creating an impact. So that feels really nice.
And, you know, fair play to you, because I mean, that takes a lot of strength and a lot of conviction to stand up for what you want, what you believe, what you want to do. I mean, and are you able to talk the language you want to talk, or are you still having to, sort of be mindful, I suppose, is maybe the right question.
Yeah, I just did an episode. I called it Censorship in the Entertainment World. So that's a big reason why I did stop performing. A lot of the locations or a lot of the venues I was potentially invited to perform in, I was asked to subdue or contain how I move when I sing, or maybe not share personal stories for myself. They were more interested in my upbringing and my parents' story. So I've definitely had that a lot. And I decided that that's not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to customize and censor my story because I was talking to high schoolers. They would prefer to shelter and not expose them too much. And I had that conversation with a fellow interviewee I just did a couple of weeks back. So it brought that back for me. I remember having to hire someone to help me write my story up. And I spent $1,000 on that. I was very happy. I had my whole thing. I was only able to use it once or twice, and I had to customize it for each concert. And then I was sitting at someone else's concert, and I was like, why did I have to hire someone to do this? And then it hit me. It was like, I needed somebody to cut my story out of my story so it would be okay for certain audiences. So that was like, oh, that's why I needed help, because I'm not a bad writer. I'm not a bad storyteller. I think I needed somebody from the outside to tell me what's okay for these audiences and what's not. And it's not because you can't really talk about it. And in certain organizations, well, communities, you definitely cannot talk about certain things. There's a lot more awareness, a lot more conversation, and I'm definitely part of that wave. of conversations being had on taboo topics.
It's interesting because this is unintentionally where sort of fire in the belly has found itself, if you like, in terms of, because we talk about, you know, we said before, I try and create a safe space. So it's pre-recorded. It's positive. You know, we're not here to run anyone down or whatever, and certainly talk about the lessons. But the number of people I talk to and saying, when's the last time you got to sit down for an hour, 2 hours, have a positive conversation, be heard, not like you're somebody's competing and waiting for you to stop talking so they can talk. And it's kind of surprising, right? You know, people go, I don't think I've ever had that in my life.
Well, I've had that with my coach. But yeah, you definitely have that energy to you. I can feel it. I can feel it like the moment we started talking, how we suddenly went into a space I normally never go when I'm being interviewed. So my radar is up.
I appreciate that. I think it's a compliment. I'm going to take it that way anyway. So no, it's all good.
Definitely.
So talk to us about the mini version of yourself then.
The mini version.
Mm.
What do you mean? Like when I was a child?
Yeah, when you were little.
I'm still little, just for the record. But yeah, the ungrown up, the minor me. So when I think back, I think I had a really happy childhood, a really unique upbringing. I definitely stand out in a room when I come in. My upbringing already can spark up a 30-minute conversation without even trying, which is annoying on some occasions. And I attribute a lot of my passion, my drive to my genetics, really. My parents are both extremely driven people. I mean, they left very comfortable westernized lives to go and live in the former Soviet Union with mice, without washing machines. And I remember my mother saying how when she wrote a paper when she was 17 in high school, one of the amazing things that Russia had was that every building had their own washing machine. And then 10 years later, when she moved there, there was no such thing. So that's just an example of how ambitious and how idealistic my parents are. And if anyone knows my family closely, my siblings, there's definitely that, I don't know if I would call it competitiveness, but there's this, every sibling is trying to do something major or important, something bigger than themselves in our life. And I attribute it honestly to just being recognized by our parents and saying, I also am like you. I can also be like you. Obviously, it goes much deeper than that, but we definitely are on a very, you know, deep level competing for their attention and recognition, because they have definitely sacrificed a lot to do what they did in their lives, and they still do. They live far away from all their children, their families. And we also want to do something meaningful with our lives.
Hmm. Makes a lot of sense. Who do you take after, your mother or your father?
Both, in an interesting combination.
Okay, give us the best parts.
So my mother is very ideas. If I had to put a name on it, she's the ideas person. You come to her, if you have a question, you know, we weren't allowed to say the word bored growing up. There's no such thing as bored. You have nothing to do. Pick up a book, play a game, do a puzzle, run around, draw a picture, dance. There are 5 million things you can consume your hour with. So, and one of my biggest things is, you know, ideas come to me. It's a really important for me to execute. So I have to prioritize. What do I really want to do? What just sounds cool? What's actually practical? Then I go and do them. And that's what's really cool, that I've actually been able to do a lot of the things I set out to do. And I started writing music just because my mother said, you know, how about you write a song? And I said, well, how do you write a song? She's like, well, try. And so, yeah, I spoke about this a lot. And anyone who knows me, you know, Moscow and Russia is very high cultured, and there's so much opportunity to to develop artistic skills. So I've been taking piano lessons since I was six. Then I went to a proper children's music school and I graduated from it a few years later in a shorter amount of time than it took because I was leaving the country and I wanted to get my degree. The level of education provided is on extremely high level, very thorough, and extremely affordable, if not completely free, basically. Maybe in the last 10 years it went up. So my parents really took advantage of that kind of access to development for children. And we were immersed in a ton of extracurricular activities. We all got to really develop ourselves in many ways and explore our creative sides, which is an extremely luxury thing. It's extremely luxurious for parents to be able to provide that if you live in any westernized country today. It's very expensive to you know, provide chess and dance and art and music and languages just on top of everything. Yeah. So I'm very fortunate to have that.
How did piano serve you?
It was my thing. It was my special thing. I was good at it. When I realized after having many conversations with professional pianists or musicians, how they were impressed with my improv skills or my composition skills. I remember I was really young when I realized if they think what I'm doing is cooler than what they're doing, then I better keep doing this. Because if I can impress somebody who could sit down and just play Beethoven or Chopin by just opening up a sheet music, which I still cannot do. I have to sit literally deconstruct each note. Yeah, I'll get it. I have the skills to do it. I can't sit down and just play fluently. So if they thought what I was doing was impressive and good and catchy and enjoyable, then I had something. That made me feel special, unique, made me feel like I have something. And I went with it. My parents definitely encouraged it.
Is it what you wanted to do, though? I mean, you know, you talked about being your thing, you know, but was it a thing to be seen? Was it a thing to be encouraged, to be recognized? Do you know what way it fell?
Can you ask that again?
Sure. In terms of, there's a concept sometimes that sometimes our voids are our values. So if we are lacking in something, then we will, it's a bit like if somebody has grown up with a lack of money, they will then become money, very money focused until they get it. And when they get money, they're kind of going, well, I don't know what to do now. I've got it. Sometimes it depends with children. Sometimes if, you know, if they're playing, is it to be playing to play, or is it playing to be heard, or playing to create, or, you know, understanding what that is. So I'm just curious if you had a view on that.
So now that you're bringing up that question, I'm thinking back and trying to see what was it like. There are a few components to it. Number one, straight up, you write something and you feel that force of creation, that spiritual, whatever feeling you get when you're writing something. That high that comes with it is really cool. It's very, very, very cool. I can't just throw that out and say that doesn't exist. Now, playing to other people and them having whatever high they get from experiencing some new music and being like, how did that 9-year-old just write that? Super cool. And then I'll add to it, I don't think I can say that didn't exist at all. Being one of 7 children with super busy parents, we had a staff really running the household between housekeepers and drivers. And that wasn't like a wealth thing. It was a community thing because my parents were community people. So we had a lot of extra help in the home. We were definitely competing for my parents' attention. And that was before smartphones. My father probably had a BlackBerry, you know, before most people had anything that was smart like that. But we were competing for their attention in a big way. And having that was definitely a way of getting recognition, for sure.
That makes sense. Where do you come in the 7 out of interest?
4. So I'm between everybody. I'm also in between all the boys, and I'm in between all the girls. Smack in the middle.
It's so you were the one that got right, yeah? So they had the practice beforehand, they got you right, and then the rest of them is kind of whatever.
Well, it's nice because, and it's not nice at the same time, but my older brothers left home at the age of 13 to study in Israel. So I was sort of the older kids for the majority of me growing up. And I did have to fight for the piano time with my older sister, but I don't remember that being a major part of my stress.
What was your earliest conscious memory then?
I don't know. It's because some of them are implanted. They're like stories that you hear your parents say, and then you're like, oh, I saw a picture of that room. So is that really memory? I don't know. I used to sleep in like a little, when I was a baby, and I probably needed my own space because I was a baby. Now that I have them, I know they need their extra spaces. So there's a little room, which was probably pantry, off of the kitchen, and that was my room. Apparently they were cockroaches all over that place. I do not remember because I was a baby, but that's definitely an implanted memory. I believe that there were cockroaches there. I don't think I had nightmares because that's not something that pops up in my life.
So are you afraid of cockroaches now or anything?
Not as much as any other thing. And I was definitely the designated cockroach killer when I was in seminary because I was the bravest one in my apartment.
I love it. So at that time, I mean, were you running into school, out of school? I mean, how was school for you?
So I took it extremely seriously. I treated it very, like the biggest priority, like it was my job. If I didn't like my schedule at the beginning of the year, it definitely stressed me out. I definitely threw tantrums. But you know how you have that classic Russian teacher stereotype of, my sister definitely had that, many of those kinds of teachers, you know, the ones that shamed you or that screamed. And just to give an example, our grades were announced to everyone in front of everyone, not like in the States. I don't know how it is in Ireland. There's a privacy in the States to your grades. There was no privacy to that. You know, if you had a bad grade, everyone shall know about it. So I had a few teachers who were more on that classic Russian side. Somehow I appealed to their sweet sides. And I got away with a lot of that tough Russian love. My music teachers were also super nice and encouraging. I never had any negative associations with practicing. I had a lot of self-inflicted stress to perform well and to do well, but it wasn't coming from teachers. My teachers were very, I wouldn't say encouraged way of education and teaching, but they weren't threatening me or shaming me.
That's interesting. So, I mean, was the pressure predominantly coming from yourself? I mean, that was the standard you were holding for yourself?
I think it's a classic overachieving, wanting attention and recognition, a middle child thing. So it makes sense. You know, I was designing my dream house when I was 8 years old. So like I needed things planned out. I needed to know what I was getting myself into. I shared a room with three people at one point. So my own space was very important to me. I was definitely innovating travel cases and luggage that had secret compartments that became closets because, you know, space and minimalism and all that was important to me as somebody who had little space and who traveled. We traveled a lot. I used to be embarrassed when our American friends or counselors would come with suitcases and tons of stuff and they would just leave messes. It was an embarrassing thing as like my Russian self because you shouldn't have so much or shouldn't be so messy. Everything should be tidy. You should be able to hold everything you have. I don't know where this came from, but it was an interesting concept. Now I'm like, the only time I'm embarrassed is when we're moving and everything's in boxes and you realize how much you have. But otherwise, I'm okay with it.
It's that thing is like, yeah, we don't have that much stuff. You know, and like the third lorry later, you're like, yeah, it's quite a lot, right? That's kids. I mean, kids have stuff, you know, it just takes a lot of boxes for them.
Oh, yeah.
So what was the plan? What were you going to do when you grew up then? You're massive, sort of high achieving, piano playing, not the instrument, early achiever. What was the big grand plan?
I don't think I ever thought that through too much. And I think classic education does not prepare you for life. They prepare you for education. They prepare you to respect and want to achieve academic excellence. They do not prepare you for bills, for taxes, for families, for practicality. And I think that should be a part of the education conversation. If people are investing loads of money into their education, and I'm not talking about doctors, even though I just spoke to a therapist the other day, he just graduated. I said, did you have one single class on business? You're starting a private practice. No. I said, well, hell, to your education, you know what to do, but you don't know how to do it now. So, and what's great is I realized I'm not so great at academics, even though I love learning so much, but the classic test and classroom style of learning is not my favorite. So I knew I had to, well, I did business in college because that was practical. That was very project-based. I came out with a presentation, wooed and what, everybody, I got my A. So I didn't have to study for a test and get an A to get my major. And it's nice to have parents who, and an environment that just supports, you know, self-development and figure it out. And as an artist, I do think it's extremely important. I think also as part of education, and I think when I parent, I will definitely bring up the practical element of it and not to drain or make it bad. I just want to frame out what that academia is not as like perfect as it seems. Now, there are people who are 30 years old, 35 years old. They keep on adding new degrees and fellowships onto their thing. They don't know how to live in the real world. They just want to go back to school because that's all they've done since they grew up, you know, since they were a kid. Scary to go into the world out there and compete for business. It's nice to stay in a lab and research.
Yeah, it's...
I'm not like shying on them, saying if that's what they want to do and they're okay sitting in a lab and they don't have to pay anyone's bills or send anyone to college, great, fine. But in a community that I was brought up in, where you get married young, you build a big family, you send them to private Jewish schools, and the conversation has definitely shifted a lot for that. You know, girls are definitely encouraged to go and get practical jobs that they could have flexible hours and earn accordingly. I mean, we're still working on that. But I think that's part of education. Teachers, principals, school administration, parents have to talk about the practical ends of it, no matter how bad it is. Even though it brings me back to, I don't know, I was in sixth or seventh grade, somebody came to talk about pensions. They weren't talking about pensions, but they were saying, if you go to this school and then you get this job, and then you get to save and have a good pension. I remember thinking they were crazy. It's like, I don't know, 10 or 12. Why are you talking to me about retirement? That's so depressing. So I guess there's a way to do it, to get through to kids or to teenagers or to young adults. But just pursuing education with no end, with no conversation about, will there be an ROI in your education? Should you spend $200,000 on something that just feels nice and will make you feel like important in the world? Or maybe you want something else from your life.
I'm curious to know where the business studies came from versus, you know, was that where your strength was versus all the sort of the creativity side and the piano and things like that?
Yeah, I definitely am a little paradox when it comes to that, because the artists usually, if you think about a classic artist, you know, they don't understand time, they're late, they don't understand deadlines, they don't understand money. Sometimes they say, you know, money's not my thing, numbers, just leave me out of it. I was very business minded and very numbers make a lot of sense to me. I don't see the world in colors, even though it's beautiful. I see everything in numbers pretty much. So I also make my deadlines all the time. I'm very frustrated when I'm working with people and they don't see deadlines like I do.
Would you be a bit of a control freak by chance?
Yes and no, because my perfectionist bar is very low. For me, good enough is great. But I put a lot of priority onto a lot, the quantity. I did a podcast every week for a year. I couldn't sustain that anymore, so now I just do them when I can. So sometimes it's 4 or 5 a month. Sometimes it's 2 a month. And if I'm having a great conversation, I'm not going to tell them that their mic is awful sometimes. You know, my level of perfection, I definitely, so in by control, I also think if I'm paying for something, I should definitely have more control. And as I do more collabs, I learn more about myself, how if I don't take control, they will, because somebody has to take the alpha position. I don't like to call it alpha, but somebody's going to take the charge position. Then I'm going to end up working for them. And that's not a fun place to be in. So going forward, even though it's not my ideal or natural personality, I'll come in with all my, you know, you're doing a song with me. Well, I think I know more than you because I've been doing this for a long time. So let me just tell you what we need to do in a really nice way. I used to just think, you know, you call yourself an artist, you know exactly what you're doing, but you might just be a little behind and just starting out. And you can learn a lot from somebody who's been doing this for a long time.
Do you get to say what you really want to say sometimes? Or do you have to?
No.
Is there always a bit of a filter on there?
There's always a filter.
Yeah. If you were to
you can feel that filter. No, I always found it much easier for me to get along with male men, boys, than women. Not that I have so many relationships with men around, but women just and girls just brought a lot more drama to the table. Maybe it's just because I had more relationships with girls, so there's more drama to be had. But there's a lot more drama to deal with. So if there's anything you're doing, you just have to bring 90% of emotional, a container for emotional stuff, 10% for what you're actually doing, 90% for all the talking through, figuring out, dividing up the roles, making everyone comfortable. And it happens at every process of your project. Yeah. But I think the fact that the project can get done and is seen is more important than me feeling like I can express myself and tell somebody they're annoying me, because that's not going to get me where I want to go. And for me, producing my projects that I invest a ton of money into, and showing them, showcasing them off. That's my goal. So if that means I have to be the peacemaker or, filter myself, so be it. My husband gets to hear the rest.
give us a glimpse of what the untethered version of you. What's is it, the creative side? Is it the flow side? Where is it?
So I'll share here, because I'm definitely going to want to invite some of my audience on here. And I appreciate the space where I can share this, because I probably won't talk about this ever on my podcast. So as an Orthodox Jew, we have lots of restrictions on how we dress. Obviously, this is a wig. I cover my hair because I'm a married woman. We wear skirts or dresses that have to cover the knee. Elbows have to be covered, necklines. So that's just a little background here. Obviously, our speech has to be very refined. There's actually restriction on you know, using bad language. So behind the mic, behind the scenes, it is a big struggle for me. I don't look like I look on my pictures, and people, you know, might think like I'm not wearing makeup. Well, I'm definitely not wearing makeup when I'm not on my pictures, but it's hard for me. It's a challenge for me to adhere to all the rules and all the, you know, the more, I'm a trilingual person, so just give me a minute. you know, there's more strict and there's less strict. So I'm definitely not going with the more strict. Wherever I can hold back or feel a little bit more in control of myself, I definitely take that opportunity. I also believe that if I compromise that publicly, like on my podcast or in my pictures or in my music videos, I will alienate those communities or those women I want to inspire, because in many Jewish communities, little girls are not exposed to mainstream media or mainstream music, and they don't even know about the singers out there because the way they dress is inappropriate, the way they sing is inappropriate. And I agree with a lot of it, and that's why they are not even exposed to it. Part of my mission is to bring good music, and not just sung by men, but sung by women. Girls should grow up knowing that there are women who are expressing themselves, there are women who are pursuing their passions. But if I go and I throw out some of the Jewish values that come with it, then I won't be viewed as somebody in their community, as someone who can be a role model for them. I will be ostracized, which I have been from certain communities based on certain music videos. I've definitely not been invited to those communities to perform. And I've had certain differences with them, you know, when being published in their news publications or media. So I've definitely had that experience, but I'm not going to be our classic, you know, rabbi's wife, the way I look all the time. Sometimes maybe. And yeah, that's me.
Well, thank you for sharing. I mean, there's a lot there. And I suppose the different versions, I mean, when you don't get invited into certain areas, or you're sort of withheld, the invitation's withheld, put it that way. Does that frustrate you, or is it, you know, as in restriction of you being able to sort of display your artistry? Or is it more the case that actually potentially the people that should and could benefit from you are not going to get to hear? I mean, what's your view on that? I mean, are you doing it for you, or are you doing it for your audience?
It's a great question. It's definitely a balance, because even if these girls are super sheltered now, they definitely have access to the internet eventually. And many of them do make their way to Instagram and do find me. You know, maybe they're a little older. Maybe they're not endorsed by their school administration, but they'll just self-endorse me because I'm singing Jewish music and I dress and I look the part, and it's appealing and great. And I'm okay to connect with women and girls on a personal level. I don't need an endorsement of a community or a school or name. And not to say there are plenty of organizations and communities that would have me. But I eliminated that whole part of my life because I don't like performing. So much energy goes into it, so little money usually comes in return. And it's such a hard lifestyle to pursue. There are other avenues where I can earn, where I could still showcase my music online and reach so many more people than performing, and I could do it on my terms. I don't have to be, you know, stressing over the fact that I'm my own sound producer and sound system, and I have to control everything while I'm singing and standing on heels, and I'm a one-woman show. It's very stressful, especially if you're traveling, you're getting up on stage after 3 hours of driving or an airplane trip. So doing my music videos, being in my studio, right now I'm in my studio, I get to really do the part I enjoy without that stress level. And then I do it on my own terms, and I connect with people on a one-to-one level.
That's, I mean, fair play to you. It sounds like, you know, obviously what stood out for me there is doing it on your own terms. It's coming across as a very powerful statement for you.
Definitely. I mean, if I was saying no to $50,000 gigs, I would probably do whatever I need to. But I was like, okay, you won't invite me for a $500 gig that will probably cost me $300 to just get my way to you, you know, and pay for a babysitter. No, thank you. Also, when people pay a lot of money, they treat you like a lot of money. You get a team, you might get a hotel room. When you're not being paid money, it's like, oh, we found you a little room in somebody's house. And like, do you want us to this and that? I'm not saying I need the VIP treatment, but if I do ever perform, that's definitely a requirement. And it's not because I feel I need to be treated in a certain way. I think the audience gets a lot out of it when they feel like they're having a star. And I think as a performer who's getting up to do their best show for someone, they need everything they need to be their best selves. So if I am eating something that is going to make me sick or frustrated or bloated, no, I probably won't perform so well. So yeah, if I need this kind of food or I need a comfortable mattress, that shouldn't be like a, you know, a full of myself thing to ask. It's more like, I have that at home. I know I can sleep a full night at home or relatively. And that's how I perform. That's how I can be my best self. That's how I could put on a good show. But if you're compromising me on literally every level, you're getting a half-ass show.
What does bring out the best version of you? Apart from a good night's sleep, of course.
What brings the best version of me? So I definitely didn't run away from, you know, wanting attention and recognition. That's definitely always there. So when I feel like there's recognition of who I am or what I've done, it helps me feel comfortable. I don't feel like I'm on defense. And I have that less and less. For the past few years, I definitely have this less and less. I used to feel like I have to defend what I do because it comes with 5 extra questions. I used to also answer questions with a question mark. Like, I do that? Does that make sense to you? Which is totally a female thing that people do. It's like a female thing because they're almost asking for approval. It's not a bad thing. It's like a preconditioned thing. I'm learning a lot about male versus female, just body language and thought processes, because I'm learning about business and sales and coaching. And I don't want to be compromising myself when I am talking about who I do, what I do and who I am. I want to sound like I'm making statements and not asking questions and not asking for approval. So once that switch happened, I'm forgetting your question.
No, I'm curious though. I mean, what was that tipping point for you? Was there a particular event or, you know, to stop asking permission?
So it's been a journey for sure. So I'll give a classic example that was like in my career as a musician, what happened. So I'm doing this music video. It costs $6,000. And we hire dancers. And I didn't say they have to have their knees covered. I didn't say that. I said, okay, whatever they're comfortable with. I don't want to be anyone's, you know, modesty police. What happened? The music video comes out. And the fact that they're dancing is already questionable. The fact that their knees are showing is like, no, no, no. So I was going to be featured in a publication and I got a really nasty email saying, you know, we know your appearance. I can't believe you would put something out like that. That's so modest. We can definitely not represent you in our community and in our media. I was working with someone at the time. I had to call her and say, well, she called me to tell me, you know, take down the video. We have to still keep you kosher, as we call it, you know, so people still consider you okay. And I told her that I cannot take that down because, well, besides from investing a ton of money into my project, a ton of time, and this is one of my best works. If you ask most people, most of my audience, you know, what they know me for, it's probably that song, that music video. It was pretty high end and amazing, even though I've released a bunch of awesome things since then. But that was a decision I had to make. Was I going to take something down, even though it was really incredible, to conform, to be accepted? Or was I going to say, you know what, this wasn't the ideal scenario. If I could go back, I would have insisted. I'm not trying to promote women's knees. That's like, I'm not standing up for that. It was, you know, it was a mistake. I should have been the modesty police on my projects, which brings me now to like, I do my projects and my collaborations. I'm coming with my list of demands, not just going to say free with the, go with the flow and do what feels comfortable to you. I'll say that to you when you come to visit me. But if we're doing a project that we're investing money into and time and we're hiring people, there's a standard and we have to uphold to that standard because I'm not appealing to Christian women. I'm not appealing to Muslim women. I'm doing this for Jewish women and they have their standards and I'm trying to reach them.
That makes sense. You said you described the song as incredible. Can you explain why?
Why? Okay. Well, not to say that just to give a little background, I filmed it 6 weeks after I had my baby, my first baby. I'm sitting on a horse. Not a great idea, just in general. But it felt so nice to be working with a team, you know, have my makeup done and people treating me like I was a singer, like I was somebody. I wasn't a part of the choir or the dance group. I was my own person. I think all the projects until then, I never worked with a team before. Here, there were many people around me all working on this project, and I was the center of attention. Besides for that, the song itself, somebody suggested, she sent me these words from the Bible. She said, you have to write music to this. You know, the men are the mainstream Jewish music out there. And they will sing about a lot of great things. But there are these few, a paragraph or text that was really highlighting a woman, Miriam, the sister of Moses, how she stood up and was a real leader. Everyone followed her. She was like, you have to write music to this. We have to sing about this. We need women empowerment songs because, you know, this is a new industry of women singing for women, not just men. And the song that came out of it was just very catchy. I definitely say it's my number one hit. I don't like to call things hits or not, but that just catches on. Three-year-olds can sing that song after they listen to it once. So it's a hit. I put a ton of money into it. We had a drone, we had horses, a beach, we had dancers. We went out and it was my first like hurrah crazy video. So it was incredible. I felt incredible. I think many young girls watch it and women and feel like, wow, you know, you don't need Ariana Grande in a bikini to think that that's what a star is. You could have somebody covered up in a beautiful white long gown, sitting on a horse, singing about a woman from our history who was a leader, who had people following her. The message, everything about the song was very empowering. And I think that definitely did not exist in this way. And it was so cool to be the vehicle to bring that to the world.
Was that you in flow? Is that your super self?
It was uncomfortable. I felt like I was acting almost. But now when I do it, I'm like, no, this is my jam. This is what I do. This is me in my element. I remember when I was getting into my wedding gown on my wedding day, and feeling like it's just one of those performances. I'm getting into a costume and I'm playing a role. And understanding, no, this is an actual life event. But that's, it's part of my life. Costumes, makeup, lights, glam and jewels and all that stuff. Because, if you're not dressing sexy, you have to just add sparkles into everything. Because we can't, men could get out in jeans and a t-shirt and they could be, your rock star for today. Women need hair and makeup and jewelry and clothing and high heels. There's no casual performance for women. There's no like, hey, that's me in my pajamas. I'm playing you a hit song. So it's not fair. So I have to use everything I have in my toolbox to make it feel special and fun.
So, it sounds almost like, you know when you're almost getting into character, if that makes sense, and not, I mean, not in a positive way, that sort of, as you say, whether it be on a horse or getting glammed up and doing the whole thing, that's you in your special place, if you like.
Yeah. Was there a question
or was it? No, it was more of a statement actually. So, yeah. Do you like horses?
Yeah, they're so beautiful.
It's great, to have that. I'm curious about the whole aspect of it, if you like. Do you feel that you deserve this, if that makes sense?
So it's a big question, and I listen to a lot of business podcasts, and there's the one with Guy Raz on How I Built This. He asks every guest, how much of this was luck? How much was this? I forgot what the other one is. What's the other? Was it luck or was it deserving? I don't know.
Yeah.
So I think it's a combination. Any success is really where consistency or hard work meets opportunity. You have to have that combination. And your question was again,
do you deserve it?
Do I deserve it? So the part that I feel I deserve is, I write great songs and I don't just say, I can't do it. It's too expensive. It's not practical. Who's going to listen to it anyway? I'm a woman. Who's going to listen to me? There's no opportunity. Like if I would do that, then yeah, maybe not. No one does. I don't deserve for anyone to hear me or for anything good to happen to me. But the fact that I climb hills and I get rejected or I get any other, negative feedback, even though a lot of the feedback I get is positive. I just want to put that out there. I do get a lot of positive feedback. The part that I feel I do deserve is the fact that I did something about it. The fact that I'm fighting, the fact that I put a ton of money into this, it's not just, and I don't want to put anyone or say anything negative about people who have, a brother or father who has a music producer and they can produce stuff for them, because I know nothing comes for free. There are always strings attached. But I had to go. We spend wedding money on my albums. We spent, I had a job just so I can pay for all of this. I still do. I don't make money from this stuff. This costs me. So yes, when I get recognition, some of it I feel I deserve because I put a lot of effort and work into it. But there's a ton of it, a huge part of it, which is not me. It's, the music that comes out of me. I don't have full control over a hit or not. I do believe if I keep writing, I'll get myself another hit, because maybe they come. But for me, I have to sit and write. And then maybe one out of 50 songs is going to be a hit. So there's this balance. But I definitely love the recognition part of it. I am not doing this only for the impact or who I will impact with this. A lot of the drive is because I would love to be. I love the idea of a female Jewish Orthodox celebrity. I love that idea. I think there's a space for it. I think it can be done in a beautiful way that's not looked down upon by Orthodox Jews.
Do you see yourself as pushing boundaries or?
Absolutely. I'm surprised you're asking me this question like an hour in. Yes, I'm a boundary pusher.
It depends. I mean, if it's pushing it for the sake of pushing it, or is it a case of, you know, why? Because some people, because when you push boundaries, you're going to get a lot of feedback, and whether it's the feedback that's actually feeding you, or it's just going, no, this is the right thing, and fighting for justice. Careful, sorry, I'm a bit careful with my language there, but you know, really sort of wanting for change or something that is potentially more deserving, if you like.
Yeah. So I wouldn't use the word justice, but more deserving. I definitely relate to that more. I think what I'm doing is not an act of rebellion. I think it's an act of creating a new space. I see what, you know, doing these interviews for 3 years on my podcast, I see the pain in other women's eyes when they say how, you know, they became Orthodox or they became Jewish or they turned 12 and they realized now they can't dance or sing. And there is a way they can do it. There is a space for it. Women's expression is not banned. There's just a way to do it that's okay. And for me, it's not about, oh, if you have something you want to express or you have a love for singing, you follow me, we will be like a new sect of Judaism. For me, it's important to find a way within Judaism for them to feel like they don't have to reject their families and communities to express themselves, to express themselves. So I think that's bringing in new opportunity and healing to a community that didn't have that. And I can do that because I came from an outside community. I grew up in a community my parents built. It wasn't a mainstream community. If to just give you background, there are communities in major mainstream Jewish places. If you do certain things, or if your parents do certain things, like have a TV or vacation, your kids might not get into the schools they want to get into. And maybe the conversation should be, if the parents have a TV, maybe they shouldn't send their kids to that school. They should send their kids to school where they don't care about you having a TV in the home. But the idea is, my parents just did what was right or what felt right to them. It wasn't about conforming or making sure their kids don't get kicked out of schools because their mother's going and performing places or putting up music videos. Yeah. Does that make sense? So I'm bringing healing. I'm bringing opportunity. I'm staying away from the whole rebellious part, because as much as there is rebellious aspects to me, this is not something I want to compromise on. I think there's something bigger than me here. And I recognize that I am a leader in this movement, and I have responsibility to not sabotage it for other people. Because if I go off and do whatever I want, then they'll use me as an example. Now you better shut your mouth and not do anything, because you'll turn into her. That's not what I want. I want little girls knowing they can sing and they can dance and they can start podcasts and they can have a tour.
When you talk about a little girl, who are you talking to?
I'm talking to a little girl who is being raised in a community where she's taught and groomed to think a certain way, to go into a profession that makes sense for her. For a girl who's going to probably get married when she's 19, have a baby when she's 20, and have another baby when she's 21, and never ask herself the question, what do I want? What makes me feel good? What will make me feel alive? So my children are not just being raised by zombies who are surviving life and doing what everyone's telling them to do. And I haven't experienced that on a personal level, but I know it exists. I've spoken to people, I've met people, I have relationships with people who grew up like that. And it makes sense. It's tradition. There's a lot of things, you know, it does make sense to have your babies when you're young. You know, there are a lot of issues that come up later on. But the question is, are we just raising robots, baby making machines? Are we raising individuals and leaders and thinkers and inspiring people?
It's under control, right?
What?
comes down to control?
So let me tell you this. If for people who don't have, you know, if both parents are mentally present, mentally healthy, relatively, they're providing financially, nothing majorly is wrong in a family. It works for many people. This works very, very well. There's a support system. You know, if anyone's sick or if anyone dies or if there anything happens, there is a community, there are organizations. Everyone's chipping in, helping out. There's a huge support system. That's 100% sure. Now, when you take anyone who's an orphan or has been abused or who has siblings who have special needs or mental health in the family, and they're not getting the help they need, or maybe they are shoving it under the rug because they don't want to talk about it because they're nervous their children won't get marriage prospects or whatever it is. Whenever there are issues that are not being addressed and not being supported, that's when this control really, really is terrible and detrimental, because not dealing with something is your recipe for a disaster. And the more okay it is to become, it is to talk about things and be open that, you know, issues happen and medical issues happen and mental health issues happen, and, you know, death you can't hide. But when things like this happen and it's normal to talk about it and it's normal that it happened to you and it's normal to go to therapy, then there is that autonomy over yourself, over your body, over your life. And that's when it's tricky. That's when it gets tricky. And it's definitely better now than it ever was. I think the internet is great. I think the fact that there's a lot more awareness and talk about issues, and the fact that there are lots of organizations that are there to support people who are transitioning or dealing with real life issues that our communities are not built to handle or comprehend.
That makes a lot of sense. And do you find yourself raising your kids differently to the way you were raised?
I would like to raise my kids in a similar way. I live in an out-of-town community, which means that it's a community school. They accept all kinds of kids, and it's not just one type, which is important to me. Diversity, seeing different teachers wearing different, you know, head coverings or different styles of, you know, clothing that represents different sects. I think that's very important. I think sheltering and fitting into a very small box is, unhealthy for me because I wouldn't be able to handle it, but I wouldn't be able to raise my kids in something that's much more closed and conformed. I'm very thrilled to be living in a community where I can be treated like a celebrity instead of something you have to hide what you're doing because it's not okay. You know what I mean? And maybe a few years ago, I would have ended. I have considered living in these communities just because they have lots more kosher restaurants and other Jewish conveniences. And maybe because I was younger, I would have just fell into it. But now where I am and with what I'm doing, I would never even want to live in a community that wouldn't support what I'm doing, where I'd have to hide who I am. Which is impossible because I'm all over the internet. But yeah.
Sick. What are you capable of?
Can you go a little more detailed into that?
It's in terms of, do you know yourself in terms of, you know, what you do obviously at the moment, and, you know, you're stepping yourself, you're pushing yourself forward there. But do you have a sense of going, is there more in you? Is there more, you know, have you a glimpse of what the power you have?
No. I think part of my strength is that I'm okay with dealing what comes my way. Mm-hmm. I am not planning things the way I used to when I was a little kid. You know, I am more go with the flow, just believe my clients will come to me, believe my next song will come to me, believe, you know, things will work themselves out and the right thing will come in at the right time instead of trying to be in control. First of all, it's a lot more stressful to live like that. And I experienced it and I needed help to deal with all of that stress. And this way is complementary to a more relaxing lifestyle. It also, I'm saying bring it on. Bring it on. Well, you know, I would love to see what I'm capable of. I don't know.
When do you feel most at yourself? I mean, is that on stage, performing, in front of the mic?
It's a hard question to answer because I love so many parts of my life, but it brought a little sadness to me when you asked that question, because even though I say, you know, I'm completely happy not performing and I chose not to do it, it's not because I don't like performing. It's because it was so not worth it for me. It was so exhausting and so energy draining. Yes, I wish I could go and perform on my terms. So I miss that for sure. Yeah. Is that the only time I feel like I'm in my element? Absolutely not. When I spend time with my husband and we have enlightening conversations, when we host, you know, dinner parties on our Shabbat meals, when I'm with my kids and they're not making me want to kill them, I love it.
That's what kids do, right? You know, they just, it's like, I love you, but seriously, it's like, push your buttons, right?
Yeah.
Oh, kids are, yeah. What, do you forward plan? I mean, in terms of, do you vision board? Do you put that all out there?
My vision is definitely to create some more amazing music and get a lot more famous. Another one of my big, big, big visions and goals is to make a lot of money. And that's not really, I had to get over a lot of the stigma and taboo about saying that out loud. But for me, it's not about status. It's not about the things I can buy. It's being a woman who has children at a young age who can make a lot of money and is not married to someone with money, or is not like that whole gender assigned roles. I want to know that I can support myself and my children. I want to know that I'm talented enough for people to pay me a lot of money for what I offer.
Why?
It's independence. It's a sense of freedom. It's a sense of peace of mind. It's like an insurance policy. If God forbid anything happens, I don't want to think, you know, now I have to sell my house and move in with, you know, my family because I cannot take care of myself. You know, if I choose to do that, and I'm talking, I used to sell life insurance. That's why I'm very comfortable talking about these topics. But the point is, I want to be a woman who can support herself. I want to be an independent woman. I think it's an important thing to teach your daughters. I think, yes, it's unfair biologically that, you know, men don't have the equivalence of bearing children and that toll that it takes, you know, if you're trying to make it in a career building a business, that you can't compare that with men. So we are at a disadvantage. Doesn't mean we teach our daughters to aim for less or to expect less of themselves. I think there's nothing more empowering than a woman who knows she can support herself and she doesn't need a man to buy herself things, that she can buy herself what she needs. She doesn't need to ask for it. You know, I have interviewed women who were survivors of domestic violence. I grew up witnessing domestic violence with some of my friends. I didn't even realize it at the time, probably. I don't want, you know, and I have two daughters. I don't even have sons yet. So I need to teach them how to be strong women. I don't want to teach them to rely on men. I think there's a lot that is important to rely on your man, but it has to come from a healthy space. Not where, you know, this is all on you, this is all on me. I think that's the traditional way. That came from a survival type of lifestyle. We're not in survival mode anymore. We're in Western society where women get an education.
Would you consider yourself, I mean, are you driven by, you know, what we call sort of toward energy or away from energy, in terms of, you know, are you doing what you do predominantly to prevent something from happening again, or prevent your girls from experiencing things? Or is it a case of you're driven towards going, well, what's possible? I could ride on a horse, I could do this, I could do that. Is it the excitement of what's possible, or is it the, you know, the away from going, I don't want this ever to happen again?
It's definitely both, because just like I was exposed to domestic violence, you know, not firsthand, but, you know, as a little kid in a home, adults might not see what little children, your friends' children, your children's friends can pick up on. But so that's something I definitely wouldn't want for myself or for anyone I'm having an impact on. Like, part of my singing and my brand is empowering women. And the other part is, you know, if I want to do more music and more crazy projects, and I have so much in mind, I need a lot of money for it, and it can't take away from all the expenses that we have to cover. So I need so much more. I'm not expecting some brand to come pick me up. I mean, some label. I'm going to be my own label. I'm going to have to, you know, cover this myself. So I definitely have a big budget in plan for some of my musical projects. I would love to do a film. And the more I do this, the more I acquire taste for better quality and more professional talent, and that's going to cost. So, and I'm all about paying artists for what they ask, for what they're worth. So I don't want to be, and when I started out, I for sure negotiated and tried to get a best deal. I don't do that anymore. I hire people who I see talent in, and I want to pay them what they ask.
That's, I mean, it's a great ethos to have, you know. It comes across a very positive mindset, you know, and, you know, setting your goals and mature, if you don't mind me saying. I think, and I don't mean that in terms of the age, but it's in terms of understanding that it's so much more than just getting the cheapest solution. It's more than, you know, it's providing value, providing service, so much more.
Yeah, because you can have the most expensive talent, you know, out there, but if their heart is not in your project, and especially when it comes to something artistic, then you're not going to get the most amazing thing you can out of that person. So sometimes you might want to hire someone less professional, maybe, but who's so much more ambitious, so much more into something. That has more value. And in corporations or in organizations, they love to say, oh, we hired the best, blah, blah, blah. Like, sometimes you'll get a better result if you hire someone maybe who's a little less known, but they'll do so much better for you because their heart's in it.
Is it, I mean, where does that heart or that hunger, where does that come from?
Well, it could be a combination of growing up post-communist Russia, where people were assigned jobs. They were told what they're going to do. Maybe you had a choice between two things. There was no capitalistic, like, if you do well, you're going to move on. It's like everyone just needed to dot their I's and cross their T's. And you get that. There's a generation of people who are just, it's work. It's work, and then you have life. In America, it's very different. And I know a lot of Western cultures, like Germany and European cultures, say, you know, it's terrible. They don't ever vacation. They're always working. But if you love what you're doing, it's not so bad. The problem is for all the people who don't love what they're doing. And then I get it. Maybe you should have a 3-month vacation. But there's a little shift here. And it's like, do what you love, pursue what you love, and then that's your life. You don't need a vacation from it. So I think I think, and it's the same in raising kids, it's not about getting everyone to a certain level or, you know, to hit certain numbers, to pass certain tests. It's really about activating the energy of the child, finding their unique talent, making them feel like they can achieve anything, because that's a productive member of society. Taming someone, saying you can't have a grade like that, or you have to go slower because you're much faster than the rest of the class. How's that going to help your country, your school, your company? That's not helpful. Help people shine. So I'm very anti-communism. I just see what effect it has on people. There's a dead energy. It's dead. There's no passion. There's no, and there is plenty of it. It comes out in different ways. Can't subdue people forever in every capacity. But if you take that away on who they are as a in their profession, then you definitely get that dead energy.
I mean, so it is so powerful, is it, whether it be a parent or a teacher or a mentor, is to, as you say, I mean, to support somebody for, you know, for that talent that's built into them, as opposed to going, no, you can't.
Yeah, I think that was one of my biggest advantages, and what I'm so fortunate is that I was able to find my thing so early on, and I got a professional education around it. I got full cheerleading support from my family. I didn't have to fight anyone to pursue it. So that's a very fortunate combination that I got. And I feel like I would love to share that. There, you know, when you do what you love, or, you know, when I'm sitting in the studio, I don't know how much time passes because that's how amazing it is. And then when your kids come home, and that's just because what it is, if I did what I enjoyed that day, I'm going to be so much more of an attentive mother that night. If I just did nothing but like do data entry for some boss, yeah, when they come home, I'm probably going to be yelling at them because everything's annoying me. So it's a really a lifestyle level. What kind of life do you want to live? Do you want to be alive? Do you want to be energized? Do you want to spend your time being in your genius zone, or do you want to just pass your time? And I guess I listened to Mayim Bialik's interview on the Freakonomics radio podcast. She said that what made her stand out and look like a nerd was that she was highly aware of her mortality from a very young age. So I would say that's definitely connected. And that's why I sold life insurance also. I'm very connected to my mortality. This is the youth everyone sings about, everyone films about. This is what my grandparents are talking about. I want to get all that they're talking about. This is my youth. I'm not going to waste it on just the status quo or what people are telling me I need to do with my life. I want to be activated.
It's funny, and so few people actually get that till it's gone. You know, it's like, yeah, I got good at that. Oh, it's over now. It's like, what are you where you're supposed to be, do you think?
For sure, because I really had to invent this for myself. I didn't go the classic education route where I didn't have the space to even ask these questions or think about this. Because I was inventing this for myself, my job, or I wouldn't even call it a job because I don't get paid for it. So that was a very confusing part of my identity until I figured out how to build a business around podcasting. So there was so much struggle to figuring out what I'm doing and why am I doing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If I'd gone for, you know, a classic career, I would be so filled morning to night with somebody else's tasks and dreams. I'd never have the time to think about what I want. But maybe I would have, because I lasted 3 months at a 9-to-5 job. I couldn't handle it.
There's an expression I heard, and it's sort of more so recently, is, you know, sometimes good doesn't happen so the great can. You know, and it's sometimes it's like you just might be in the middle of good. It's quite possible. People going, yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I'm good. Well, that's said with the certainty of a slap in the face, basically. But do you know what I mean? Sometimes it's, I'm curious by that, by, I think, you know, and I love the fact you talk about it's the persistency of turning up. you know, it's the podcast, it's the getting the episodes out, it's the continuity of it, it's the keeping going, keeping going. Wouldn't it be so much easier to just go, do you know what? I accept. I'm done. You know, I'll fall back into line. Leave me alone, you know. But it's in you. I mean, you can tell there's a hunger, there's a drive that it just, you just keep going, you know. And I kind of imagine.
It's hard work. Emotionally, it's a lot of hard work. Yeah.
But I mean, I obviously, well.
It pays off.
I was going to say, is the price worth the reward?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to last.
And that young girl you talked about, is that you or is that a form of you or someone you know?
Which young girl?
When you talked about, you know, sort of the avatar, the, you know, who you're sort of sensing.
I'm talking to. Mm. Not really, because my parents raised us to make our own decisions. I remember being very upset about that. I remember thinking, my friends, her father's filling out her applications. No, I had to fill everything out. I had to decide which school I wanted to go to. My parents were not going to decide for me. Like, I'm 16. Tell me where I should go. No. They're not going to tell you who to marry. They're not going to tell you where to go to school or what to do. Maybe at some points they said, you're not going to go to that school, or here are your two choices because this is what we can afford, or stuff like that. But it wasn't. We were raised with a very strong self, some of us. I know some of my siblings will say they had a different experience, but we were definitely encouraged to be independent and mature, and that we are responsible for our own decisions.
That's, and I mean, it's a great way to be. I mean, that's a fantastic talent to bring to your kids as well, as, you know. What is it? I can't remember. So there's an expression by Carl Jung, I think it is, or Carl Jung. He talks about, you know, it's I'm trying to find it. I can't even remember now, but it's on the line. Yeah, that's what it's. Thinking is difficult. That's why most people judge. You know, that's why having a deep conversation or something else, it's like you can both be right or you can both be wrong, but that's okay. You know, you're right no matter what you say. Just trying to,
yeah, absolutely,
have that thought. What's your main goal? What is your sort of, where do you resource and pull all your energy toward?
Oh, I feel like I just went around in circles talking about it for the last hour and a half. But I'd like to make an impact. I'd like to be somebody important. I'd love to leave a legacy. Yeah. I'd love to have meaningful relationships throughout my life and really, you know.
Good way to have it. What's a guilty pleasure for you?
I have so many. I love TV, but now it's more of like, I have to do my TV time because it gives me content. It gives me great. So I get to even, you know, spruce that in. I am not a business expensing my Netflix subscription yet. But I definitely don't feel guilty when I watch TV. I definitely need a few days of binge watching from time to time. Absolutely. I love eating. I love good food. I have driven a few hours just to eat somewhere. And once I realized, you know, if I wasn't Jewish, I wouldn't have to drive a few hours because there are plenty of non-kosher establishments around that are probably great. So it's not such a weird thing. You know, but yeah, I've definitely wasted hours to eat good food. And when I plan vacations, food is definitely a priority. Like if we're going somewhere where we're going to have to eat potato, like oranges and canned tuna, I am not going to that vacation. They have to have restaurants. Guilty pleasures. I love spending money on my music. So like, people think somehow because it's my brand, it's okay. Or I don't know. My husband has been so supportive. Like I put a lot of money into this stuff and it's because I really enjoy it and help me build a brand that I monetize from, but it's not a direct, you know, spend money in a video, you get 5 clients. That's not really how my business works.
Do you think, do people generally get you?
I have so many parts of me that they find something they can get. Isn't that what people do in general with public figures?
I suppose you've got the outward you, the inward you, the family you, the mother you, the wife. Yeah, I mean, it's just some people sort of go, yeah, no, people just don't get me, but that's okay too. But, or, you know, just a curious question, so.
I don't surround myself with people who don't. I sort of place my energy, I put it out, and then I let people come to me. And if they want to be in my life, they can be in my life. I also have a strong family, like a lot of family members. So I don't have to go out looking for friends if I don't want to. And they all get me because they knew me since I was a baby.
That's good, isn't it?
Yes. And there's deep value on individuality and expression and individual thought.
That's a great way to be. Love it.
So not to say there's no drama. There's always drama, but it's great, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not trying to paint a perfect picture of my life. I've went through so much pain. I still go through, you know, pain and things that really hurt me. I'm not trying to say or come across as, you know, I have this perfect life. I like to look at it from the happy perspective and from the positive things that come out of it. But I'm not saying my life is perfect. Or my family is perfect.
I think it's balanced too, right? You know, it's, I mean, when there's kids involved, they have different emotions, different wants, needs, family, everyone's different, right? We've all got different passions, beliefs, expectations. But it's being respectful and doing all that. So if we were to try and summarize your fire in the belly in one or two words, what would it be?
Well, activating that voice in people. In myself, like always asking myself, is there anything I am not saying? Is there anything I'm not doing because I'm scared of judgment, self-judgment, you know, fear of failure, fear of being seen too much. So it's activating that.
Which would be worse, judgment or self-judgment?
Well, self-judgment is the only judgment because others who judge, who cares? There's always going to be somebody who judges. That should never affect you. It's the self-judgment. And even if other people judge or whether they judge or not, it's our perception that they're judging that's really toiling with who we are.
Could go deep on that. But yeah, that's true. It is true. How can people reach out to you, get a hold of you, track you down, hunt you down?
Best way to reach me is through Instagram. I'm Francisca Music. And that's it.
Cool.
Are you done with me? You said 2 hours.
Final words, you tell me.
No, we're done. This is a lot of fun. So I didn't want it to end, but...
Cool. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being on and for sharing. I appreciate your openness and honesty. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was another great episode of Fire in the Belly. You know, this really wouldn't be possible without our great guests taking the time to share their personal journeys. And by the way, sometimes it is personal. It's an absolute pleasure to have that and then to hear the journeys that people have been on. We've loads more episodes coming up soon, and it's always a pleasure to have guests on. If you do happen to know anyone with true fire in their belly, please reach out to us so we can share their journey, lessons, and successes. So, all that's left to say is have a great day, live with fire in your belly, and be the mightiest version of you.